And welcome to another edition of The Deepest Lore. I'm here and joined, as ever, for these Mayfair set reviews. Horace, how are you doing, Horace, this week?
I'm all right, thanks. Yeah, sorry I was a bit late. It's my fault, everyone listening. Not really, but I'm just taking a heat for you. I'm really stoked that that guy from Reform, that spokesman, opened up a can of worms the other day. So I'm really grateful to him for that. And it just seems like a good moment to direct people to my Substack, where matters like what he raised are discussed.
Are you kind of benefiting from the increased traffic of interest in Hitler's neutrality pact and things like that?
Like, slightly. Yeah, more so now that I've said this. Everyone go check it out, please.
I tell you what I mean, this is actually relevant to the Adam Curtis reviews that we've been doing, because, you know, a big theme of Oceans Apart, which is the series we started with, and indeed all of them, have been, I guess, a reassessment of Churchill as a statesman, as a figure, as a hero. And, you know, I don't need to remind anyone that I have come to the conclusion that he is not, you know, he is arguably a bigger traitor to the country as the current Tory party are. But what I found interesting was how strong the establishment seemed to think you're just not allowed to say that, or you're not allowed to have the opinion that other actions should have been taken.
And it's self-evident as well. Like, just someone slightly violates it and that's a news story. Yeah, there's no need to explain why, it's just news. He said that, that's news, that's bad, get rid of him.
And Simon Roberts, welcome back.
Good evening. Good evening, all. You knew him first as the Alex Ferguson of YouTube, carefully picking the team, moulding the talent. And then he was the Vince McMahon, shaping the narrative. And now he's Dr. Nima.
Zero sense.
I tell you what, if Horace has been playing the heel on these shows, how much is Dr. Steve Turley a natural babyface? You just can't dislike the guy. He's one of those, I think people can only, even if you disagree with him, he's got an infectious optimism.
It was a lovely stream. He was a really nice man.
He can only play babyface. He's like, there are only a few people like that who never turned. Ricky the Dragon Steamboat was one of them. Trying to think of any other people who never turned. There's like a handful of people who just cannot be heels whatsoever. So Steve Turley is the Ricky the Dragon's steamboat of YouTube, I guess.
Did Macho Man ever go bad?
Yeah, he was the Macho King. In fact, he debuted as a heel.
He betrayed the Ultimate Warrior as well, didn't he?
And he used to hide behind Elizabeth. That was his whole thing. And he was controlling. And there was a weird thing where Elizabeth, he is a heel with a babyface manager, which was a unique dynamic. And
she was a babyface.
She was a baby face, but he was a heel, controlling psychopath who would also just hide behind her and stuff like that, despite being called the Macho Man. And he made her open the ropes. Macho Man did. He made Elizabeth open the ropes for him to go through. So he wasn't like, he was kind of abusive husband, essentially.
Right.
And then that was how he turned face for a while when he became the champion. But that was how they turned him heel again, because he got insanely jealous of Hulk Hogan when they were
the pythons wrapped around Elizabeth's little body.
If you remember, I think it was I don't want to go off on too much of a tangent. At SummerSlam 88, they were against Ted DiBiase and Andre the Giant, and Elizabeth took a kiss off, and that's how they won the match. But then in the celebrations previously, when he won the belt, Hogan was involved, and Hogan was putting like Elizabeth on his shoulders, and she was sitting on his bicep and stuff. And
yeah.
you could just see Savage was just hating. I mean, it was marvelous, marvelous storytelling, because they used to tease things for months and months and months back in those days. So, you know, one of the best bits of TV ever, that whole kind of 3-year period there. Anyway, speaking of great television, we are going to be wrapping up with the Mayfair set. But before we get going, Simon, anything you'd like to plug, sir?
Not for me, but I'd like to plug for our friend of this parish, Justine Brown. She has a Twitter account at @Brown_bookshelf, Justine Brown's bookshelf. She's just published a book, The Private Life of James II, with Pen and Sword. Buy it now.
And Horace.
Well, anything I want to plug, I think you'll have the link below the video. It's eternalhorace.substack.com, or on Twitter, I'm at infinitehorace.
And I'll just remind everyone, do buy my courses at the Academic Agency. I'm in the zone. I'm plugged in now. I'm doing Shakespeare stuff every day. So Foundations of Shakespeare should be out soon. But in the meantime, pick up the Trivium, Foundations of Economics, all the politics, all the old courses, the Mega Bundle, all of the other courses by other people on there as well. Buy it now. The Shakespeare one, I'm going like way too in depth, and I'm losing like whole hours where I was like, for example, you may be interested, Simon, that Midsummer Night's Dream was written on the occasion of a wedding. Okay. Mm-hmm. One of the little things is that the character of Theseus in the play was meant to be a kind of analog of the father of the bride. So, you know, he's kind of like a master of ceremonies, but that was all there to kind of flatter the highest ranking nobleman there, who would have been the father of the bride. Mm. But I then went down, like, what wedding was it? And then I went down a rabbit hole of, you know, consulting dozens and dozens of old books to see if I could work out which wedding it was, which is completely extraneous. But this is the sort of thing I'm up to at the moment.
Hyper detailed. Yes. A little bit of Simon Roberts deep lore. I played Oberon at school in the production. So that's Oberon, King of the Fairies. Make of that what you will.
And, a fitting bit of casting there.
Also, yeah. Love Steve Turley's comment about wrestling is a Shakespeare for rednecks. I thought that was basically true.
Who played Titania?
Oh.
Was she hot?
No comment. You know,
that's another weird thing about that play, is that Shakespeare takes all the characters from wildly different places. So like Titania is straight out of Ovid, I think, whereas Oberon comes from a completely different mythical tradition and from folklore and stuff like that. So there's a lot of weird mixing and matching of English folklore, classical sources, stuff he just makes up. Stuff from Chaucer. There's a ton of Chaucer in the play. So, yeah. Often in performance, Oberon and Theseus are often doubled up. You didn't play Theseus, though.
No, I didn't. No.
It's kind of rare to have two separate people playing those two roles. But,
the most interesting version I saw was there's an Italian disco version out there, I think, from the early 80s on film somewhere. It's got Oberon as a kind of pervy man in a Mac who keeps sort of busting in on ladies in the nightclub toilets kind of thing. So it's that sort of dark sex sort of interpretation you were talking about earlier on Twitter, the kind of, you know, where you're stopping your Shakespeare scholarship.
I always thought that Midsummer Night's Dream would lend itself very well to a BDSM rendition, because at the start, you know, when Helena is going after Demetrius and he's going like, I hate you, you dog, you know.
Use me as your dog, yeah.
Use me as your dog. I'm your spaniel and all this. And I always thought it's kind of quite kinky. There's a lot of like weird kink. And also when Titania is going after Bottom, and she's kind of got him ensnared in that kind of, you know, and then he kind of gets into it. He's like, yeah, bring me a few more nuts. Quite like the nuts. And he's obviously being like dommed by. Anyway, let's get into Adam Curtis before we get off on one too much.
Opponents of the market economy are themselves the victims of its success on BBC Two now in the final chapter of the Mayfair set.
Britain's power and influence has declined since the beginning of the century. And the question is this a trend we can reverse?
We are concerned with making money. That is what we're trying to do.
It's been described as the most beautiful terrace house in London.
The abuse of business and financial power.
You lied.
We shall have a harder Christmas than we have known since the war.
Economic activity is best left to the private sector, with market forces being encouraged to operate.
Come with us, then, towards the next decade. Let us together set our sights on a Britain where 3 out of 4 families own their home.
During the election of 1987, Mrs. Thatcher celebrated an economic boom, created, she said, by the power of the free market.
A Britain where there is a resurgence of enterprise, with more people self-employed, more businesses, and therefore more jobs.
But 5,000 miles away, in the Mexican jungle, an old tycoon brooded. He was James Goldsmith, and he had been pushed aside by the boom.
I just want to say an underappreciated Curtisism, but thousands of miles away.
Yes.
You know, that was just a classic Curtis bridge.
He now believed that Mrs. Thatcher's government had lost control of the economy. They had been taken over by the power they had unleashed, the force of the global markets. And that night, as Mrs. Thatcher rode to victory, another embittered tycoon sulked in his London house. He was Tiny Rowland, and he too had been marginalised by the onrush of the economy. Rowland believed that the Conservative Party had been corrupted by the boom. Both these men wanted vengeance for their loss of power, and both now set out to destroy the Conservative Party.
Based.
Very, very based.
And they would be joined by a third vengeful tycoon who had been cast aside. He knew that the government had become corrupted by the growing power of money.
Can I ask, what's with the Mohammed Al-Fayed, Jimmy Cranky look? Is he an AC/DC fan, or what's the
Nicola Sturgeon couldn't always play it. She was sometimes doing films and stuff, so... No, he's probably making some point about being honest, I guess, isn't he?
Some sort of scout's honour, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Because he was a liar. Yeah.
He could be a fan of the extremely obscure Kinks album, Schoolboys in Disgrace, but that would be pushing it, probably.
All these men had helped to bring the markets to power. But now they wanted someone to reassert control over the monster they had created. But what they got was not quite what they expected.
Can we pause?
Yay! Yeah. Yay, anyone?
Oh, no. Lovely bit of Curtis montage there. I want to sort of just try this on you. This, you know, my theory about these are the kind of Blair tetralogy parts of Curtis. You've got this one, you've got Century of the Self about the sort of weaponization of psychology for persuasion and propaganda. You've got Power of Nightmares about the confection of foreign policy, you know, to persuade at home. And you've got the Trap about the game theory behind modern politics, all of which intersect with Blair. And I was thinking today, I wonder if there's an element of the Mayfair set is a little bit like the Star Wars prequels. It's basically the merchants try to take control of the system, but all they do is arouse the Dark Lord who's lurking within.
And this is young Palpatine.
Yeah.
Perfectly possible.
James Goldsmith, the new Gunray of all of this.
It's a lovely voyeuristic shot there as well, Blair through the bushes.
Hmm.
In the early 1970s, Goldsmith and Rowland had been glamorous, powerful figures. The Conservative government, led by Edward Heath, had created a boom by pumping money into the economy. The stock market soared ever upwards, and the new tycoons used the power this gave them to take over some of the biggest companies in Britain. They were seen as men who would create a new, prosperous Britain. When Goldsmith took over the giant food company Bovril, he ruthlessly sold off any part that didn't make a profit for the shareholders.
They were going to rejuvenate British business that was moribund, and Britain too.
What did Bovril make other than the, you know, Marmite-like jar thing that we can still buy in the shops, like, and gravy? They said he cut parts of the business. Were Bovril making jam and...
Bovril bought up all the other beef drinks in Britain and then just merged them all into one. And thus was born a big beef drink.
Mm. I'd love to know what Bovril used to make.
They were bringing a new dynamic.
Triple A loves some Bovril, by the way. Just FYI. It's one of the few ways I can get it to have guaranteed beef protein.
Yeah,
exactly.
Of ruthlessness that was necessary to clean out some of these businesses, get rid of, indulgences, you might say, in businesses, work for the shareholders. And people were believing it. Shareholders were believing and getting on the coattails of these people. I think there was a fair amount of massaging of paper and the proliferation of paper in these takeovers, which cost many people a great deal in the long term.
But back then?
Back then it was seen as a renaissance of British business.
This is Mr. Roland.
Just for a second, taking that word renaissance there. There's something about the way Curtis is kind of framing everything in the old world and this sort of, you know, the old tycoons brooding in their mansions. It's the sort of end of the old kind of history. You know, I spoke last week about how he's very influenced by Max Weber, who sees history as these sort of chaotic forces. But this is very much sort of great man theory of history, where you are with the Mayfair set. And it's this idea that these are agents of elite agency with these personalized motives of wanting things like revenge. They're not just simply dry economic motives, despite their activity. And it almost gets amplified into this sort of Jacobean tragedy sense as well. These kind of brooding lords in their castles waiting to pounce.
Yeah, I do actually think there's some truth to it, because the old-fashioned tycoon who can wield executive power, as we talked about before, almost like a kind of monarch of a company, a bit like Elon Musk is now, as one example, against a more kind of faceless, bureaucratic managerial class, you do get figures like Blair who are individuals who wield power, but it's a lot more of a kind of system, isn't it, that they're up against, which is hard. Like, there's a lot of you think of a House of Cards or Yes Minister or something, you know, the permanent civil service, or the management consultant, these sorts of characters.
You sort of see it by the end of this episode, where people like Goldsmith are trying to scale out their ambitions to save the world, but they're not plugged into this, you know, the techno structure matrix that we have from last week, this increasingly ordered and organized and distributed power network that comes to be, as we see in later Curtis's.
That's just picking up on the last thing you said there, Simon. That's sort of something I'm not sure if I did emphasize it last week. It was like, I think last week's episode was called, was it Attack the Techno Structure?
Destroy the Techno Structure.
And that's what sort of Goldsmith and that were doing. But it is significant that the episode ended with them basically being defeated. The techno structure, to a large extent, reasserted itself, perhaps in new forms. But But yeah, it lived, and they were shoved aside.
I mean, do you think Curtis is on the side of the techno structure? Because this is something that I wonder about, because he has been critical of Goldsmith and Co. But like you're saying, there's a kind of, dare I say it, Shakespearean sympathy
this is his major theme about wanting to tell a big story. And the way he does it is by fixing on these people, whether they're well-known like Goldsmith or some of the characters he picks out in other documentaries, you know, the kind where he usually introduces them with, you know, so-and-so is almost completely forgotten today, but he was incredibly influential. And I think he does rather like the idea of heroic storytelling on a scale. He compares things to like War and Peace, where you might see a battle from the viewpoint of a dozen different people. And he likes this idea of a heroic personal agency, perhaps, and something that kind of surmounts that feeling of helplessness that you get in a sort of a technologically organized civilization as we become.
I think Curtis is more sympathetic to the techno structure than the other side. But I also think partly just out of presumption, as in he hasn't questioned all the way back, you know, how did those guys get in charge in the first place? I don't have the full answer to that either, but a lot of people wouldn't examine that. They would take certain things as givens. You know, it's something we talked about in the previous episodes, that a lot of people treat the post-war consensus as a given or as like the high point of civilization in some cases.
Yeah.
I think Curtis has an element of that, although he does question it a lot more than most people.
And I could agree with you, because he has that conflicted quality in everything he talks about, but that, you know, that sort of propels his work on, I think.
Makes it interesting, yeah. I don't think we'd be watching him if that wasn't there.
I mean, do you think there's an element of that confusion that we're talking about in a lot of the kind of Radio 4 class who you'd imagine would be watching this? Or I don't know. I mean, we've talked about that character, John Gray, before as well, where it's never quite clear, because they see things so clearly in some ways, but in other ways, it's like, well, hold on, you're for this. It's hard to... I do think that as we go forward, you know, in the next few documentaries, Curtis does start to break apart the techno structure himself a lot more. But maybe at this point in his career, he's still just figuring it out or something like that. So.
Very much so.
Tiny Roland was doing the same in Africa. He was taking over the old British-owned companies that had once dominated the empire. Roland used ruthless methods to build a vast industrial empire. This included bribing the new rulers of independent Africa. They were methods that shocked the merchant banks in the city of London. And his bank, Warburg's, resigned because he was uncontrollable.
I think his determination was fully matched by his corruption, and he was utterly ruthless. The ends to which he would go to achieve his broader objective, I think we're a great deal further than anyone else. That I always found quite worrying. I never felt that he and we would have the same ideas as to where the cutoff line was.
But then, in 1973, the tycoon's brief moment of power was destroyed. The stock market crashed disastrously. The Conservatives' boom had turned sour. It had led to inflation and industrial violence. And in November, the Arab oil price rise pushed the market over the edge. It fell further than in the crash of 1929. The politicians now turned on the tycoons. When Roland's corrupt methods were revealed, Edward Heath publicly called him the unacceptable face of capitalism. And Goldsmith was now seen as a greedy spiv who had torn British industry apart to make himself a fortune. He left England to go and live in America. It was also the end of the idea that politicians could control the economy. Ever since the war, governments of both left and right had believed that they could manage the economy by varying spending and taxation. But now, the chaos produced by the Conservative boom overwhelmed the new Labour government. They finally admitted that they had lost control of the economy.
We used to think that you could spend your way out of a recession and increase employment by cutting taxes and boosting government spending. I tell you in all candor that that option no longer exists, and that insofar as it ever did exist, it only worked on each occasion since the war by injecting a bigger dose of inflation into the economy on every occasion, followed by a higher level of unemployment as the next step.
I tell you what I want to see.
What's that?
Labour in power again.
Labour in power? Was that the Marx Brothers?
Nah, another bunch of comedians.
Coming shortly, the Conservatives.
Just interesting hint there, that that famous advert there, product of Saatchi and Saatchi, who did the Tory campaigns throughout the 80s. I think it's interesting in that it sort of presages this new era, the rise of a communications class, which we sort of more fully realize later on in Century of the Self.
I was going to say, I mean, the target audience of a lot of messaging during that period was a kind of aspirational working class, and you could see it in the kind of accents and where those people were from. And it's interesting to think about Thatcher as a kind of high-low alliance against, Labour, essentially, against leftist elites, Marxists, and so on and so forth. And that I've watched, on previous shows, we've watched a lot of 1980s adverts as well. Mm. And there's that kind of working man page three kind of viz thing that runs through the whole, it's like an undercurrent to the whole culture of the period, where a lot of the messaging is aspirational. So you get your polo, your guy playing polo with the aristocrat, but you also get the would-be loads of money still going to watch the horses or whatever it was,
I don't know if anyone watching wants to see more about what you just said there, but this interesting remark about loads of money in this documentary that Martin Durkin made, I think I mentioned it already, actually, but it's called Thatcher, the Death of a Revolutionary. It came out just after she died, must have been prepared before. And in that, I think it was Janet Daly from The Telegraph who was just saying, this is what middle-class comedians like Harry Enfield thought of upcoming working-class people who, weren't interested in socialism, basically, weren't interested in the state, wanted to work for themselves. That's how the sort of threatened upper, not necessarily upper class, but, the upper middle class and stuff, that's how they regarded the, what would you call it, the social mobility. It's perhaps a bit of a kind name, but I just thought that was an interesting observation, that that was a reaction against opportunities for the working class in their eyes, in Martin Durkin's eyes.
Yeah, and that those people who you could call kulaks or the white van man or the, it's the kind of, plumbers, people like
petty
that.
Petty bourgeois.
Yeah, they have remained strong, like Tory base from this period up until, I would say, this election, where that's probably going to change again. Yeah. But I mean, that has been they've been an enduring part of who is in the Tory anyone basically who's self-employed or runs a small business.
The so-called strivers.
Yeah. And also possibly some of their employees as well. So, I mean, less so a worker who works for a big organization or factory, but let's say there's a small plumbing outfit and he's got like four or five employees. I'd imagine those guys under him who may dream of one day starting their own plumbing business, they would also become natural Tory voters, I think, as well. So
It's interesting beginning where you get the natural strategic demographic appraisal in the 80s. It's Essex man, with Blair, it's Mondeo man. And even in the I think 2019 election, Nick Timothy came up with the Erdington man, you know, to kind of calibrate and represent the sort of tenor of your optimum voter, let's say.
Yeah, and I mean, I do think the left are quite good at spotting these things and then making fun or exploiting them or drawing everybody's attention to it as well. Because the media have never represented, for example, in a mocking way, let's say the Ash Sakar, who is also a type, right? Mm. But it's never had a comedy character attached to it. So,
in 1979, Mrs. Thatcher was elected. She believed that all attempts by governments to manage the economy were doomed and led to disaster. The crash of 1973, she was convinced, had been created by Heath's attempts to control the economy. Instead, she was going to give up power and let the free market operate with as little regulation as possible.
I think a great deal of the idea of the power of the government was illusion. It was perhaps true in the 19th century. It was no longer true in a world becoming increasingly globalized. One has to give up trying to control. One of the first things we did, and it was a very significant one, was to get rid of exchange control. Remember, still in 1979, you had to get permission to change more than small amounts of money into other currencies, because we were trying to control the price of sterling. It always failed. And from there on, we realized that it was the way to go, to de-restrict, to deregulate, and to let the market operate.
When the Conservatives removed...
I think dangerous to allow other foreign powers, essentially power over your exchange rate myself, but I don't know what you guys think.
I'd say anyone who wants to watch see more about what Temit just said there and what you said was this documentary called Tory, 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 like as in Torah, Torah. That's on YouTube as well. And it's a fairly even-handed look at how the ideas of Thatcherism built up, especially before they got into power as well as after. And yeah, like the thing of like exchange controls might seem like a small thing, but it was the case that you were only allowed to take out, as the advert used to say, £5 in notes out of the country. And it was, like you just couldn't spend any more money abroad. Things like that is, you know, some people think these things are, well, there were things of the post-war consensus anyway, but that was, an example of how closely controlled people were.
And do we say the post-war consensus is something that, based on what they're talking about, that stock market crash in 73, is this something that sort of economically ends in the early 70s and it's only really politically dead by the late 70s? It's like a sort of super tanker under its momentum, just losing speed.
That sounds roughly right consensus. To me. A lot of people who speak in terms of neoliberalism, as in what came after the consensus, they date it to that Callaghan speech that was on a few minutes ago, which I believe was 75. And that was admitting that what we've been trying to do for the last 30 years, we can't do it anymore. The inflation is just too bad, and the other problems, especially inflation. And so a lot of people say Labour started off neoliberalism at that moment. And Thatcher, I think 4 years later, Thatcher came in and then obviously much deepened it.
Exchange controls. They opened Britain up to the growing force of the international financial markets. Money could now move in and out of the country at will. It meant that the bankers in the City of London were now free to raise huge amounts of money from anywhere in the world. They could then use that capital to finance the buying and selling of hundreds of companies. And in the process, the bankers, not the politicians, would change Britain.
When exchange control came off, suddenly the floodgates were open. And we realized that we were actually going to go through a period where change was going to happen.
Just amazing that this is the first guy we see after that. I don't know. The politicians will no longer control it. It will be the market. Here's this dude. I'm just saying.
What was his thing last week? He was in it last week, wasn't he? I can't remember what he was notable for. He was one of the people who was driving change as well. He's talking about it quite detachedly, wasn't it? But he was someone who was, I think he was financing leveraged buyouts, which were leading to massive job losses. I think he was part of that. But he talked about it as though it was bad and he wasn't part of it, but he was. I think Morgan Grenfell's a, you know, a merchant bank or an investment bank.
And we were in a position to make it happen. And we were the only people in a position to make it happen. And people like myself saw that you could do things which before had never been done because of those restrictions. And now they were gone. The world was the oyster to play with, to finance, to arrange finance, to take over.
15 years before, when the tycoons had been buying up companies, the banks had played a minor role. But now, the banks were in charge. Now, they targeted old companies and financed entrepreneurs who then bought them up. Factories were sold off and thousands of workers were sacked. Everything was done to increase profits and maximise the return to the shareholders. It helped to fuel a growing boom on the stock market. It was the ruthless reconstruction of British industry by the power of the market.
I think they saw the opportunity to make large amounts of money. That's what they saw. Because unshackling capital just gave them the freedom that they wanted to...
I will just note, by the way, another kind of dilapidated office behind this dude.
Yeah.
Kind of... Curtis loves these spaces, doesn't he? I just want to get my head around exactly what they're doing, by the way. They're essentially using the same corporate raider strategy, if I can understand it. Only this time it's being initiated by investment banks who are telling investors, listen, we'll give you the capital, we'll give you a big loan, or we'll help facilitate this if you want to go for it. It's an opportunity. And then the investment bank gets the fee. Is that right?
Yeah, they often, I think, they make a market in whatever financial instrument the entrepreneur needs to take over the company. I think that's often the role of the investment bank. And for doing that, they earn quite a lot because their role is like essential to that process. I think like JP Morgan was doing this late 1800s, early 1900s. Like US Steel was a famous one that JP Morgan, like, just, I don't know exactly, like put together the consortium, like arranged and organized the consortium that that financed and then became, you know, the board of directors and so on of US Steel. And then he handed over a check of something like $300 million to Andrew Carnegie, who had been the biggest person selling to them. And but it's not like, yeah, like Morgan, I think, got a huge fee for doing that. And maybe one of their guys was then a director on US Steel's board and stuff like that. So it's that they play, they're sort of, yeah, the arrangers, and obviously they sometimes provide the finance themselves as well.
One of the roles of the investment bank is to facilitate mergers and acquisitions, which means if you think about it, they have a, and they get, like you say, if it's a massive deal, they'll get some percentage of that as a fee. So they're quids in when a merger and acquisition happens. But if you think about it, they're also incentivized to create more mergers and acquisitions because it's like, I think, one third of the investment bank business is M&A.
And that is, according to Murray Rothbard, that is the story of JP Morgan in those couple of decades I mentioned, that most of these mergers didn't go very well and weren't a success and didn't make a lot of money, but Morgan did. Because Morgan was mainly concerned with the merger process itself. Rothschilds did a lot of finance like that, and they didn't end up owning large pieces of each company. They just put it together and then sold out.
If you think about what's actually happening, they say merger and acquisition, but 9 times out of 10, whatever the bigger organization that's absorbing the smaller one, what they'll do is they'll just shut down most of the smaller one and absorb it into their overall operations, and then it'll just cease to exist and loads of people will become unemployed and buildings will be shut down and so on. So what happens, like, even happens today. It happens in the tech space, where IBM and Microsoft are constantly buying up all of these promising startups or smaller companies or competitors. Mm-hmm. And you know, then they initially say, oh, we'll carry on some of their products, and then within a year or so it either gets spun into the IBM blob or just completely discontinued or whatever. So Anyway, let's carry on.
I just wanted to just quickly mention an interesting contrast to that way of doing things is that Warren Buffett of Berkshire Hathaway, obviously he's very old now, but his career is of not using credit, not using leverage, never did a leverage buyout in his life, as far as I know. He did obviously accumulate a lot of capital in the first place, but then he would buy companies whole and just keep them as they were, but it's just the profit comes to me now, you know. It's like, so it can, his company, his record shows that it can be done. You just accumulate the capital in the first place and wait until you can buy things at a satisfactory price. He was very good also at just negotiating as well. But leveraged buyouts is not the only way to build a big company, even a huge conglomerate like Berkshire Hathaway. It can be done by just saving, and he shows that. But these guys, you know, the story that Curtis is telling is as much one of credit conditions, like the availability of capital. And that is what Big Bang, what they're talking about here, the Big Bang in the city, or was it called Big Bang? Is that the right term? The Big Bang, yeah, like the moment when there was a sudden across-the-board deregulation was when it was just an opening up of new possibilities. It's like we're no longer having a list of certain banks that can operate in certain ways, and depending on which category you're allowed to do this, you're not allowed to do that. It was much more open. It was like, just got to do some basic registration and you can operate in all sorts of fields. It's up to you, but you're obviously free to fail as well.
Do essentially whatever they wanted. They looked back to a golden age of capitalism when there weren't any uppity unions, when there weren't Labour governments that wanted to prevent them from doing all the things which they'd traditionally done. Then you can create boom conditions. They set out to reconstruct it.
But then, into the midst of this boom, came a very unwelcome ghost from the past. Tiny Roland. Ever since the crash of 1973, Roland had been shunned by the establishment. But now he saw in this takeover boom an opportunity to restore his reputation and to make a great deal of money. And the way he was going to do it was to take over Britain's most famous department store, Harrods.
Harrods represented respectability and a very excellent commercial enterprise. Everyone looked up to Harrods.
Sorry, but the basic scheme of winning the respect of polite society by buying Harrods reminds me tremendously of the sort of thing the Penguin would do in the back. It's a very Penguin-style plot, really.
And you do mean the Penguin. You don't mean the Penguin archetype, as you used
to say. No, I mean the actual Penguin in Batman. I mean, that's just a classic Penguin storyline, that he would do something like that. But anyway, let's carry on.
It does seem really tawdry on the face of it, doesn't it? Just putting on a new cloak, basically.
Yeah.
People were coming from overseas to shop there, and the name of Harrods, and it promoted the owner of Harrods, was something which he felt would in fact achieve one of his aims, acceptability.
But Roland was not acceptable to the merchant banks. They were running the takeovers, and he was the sort of entrepreneur they knew they couldn't control. He also represented a seedy and corrupt past, the unacceptable face of capitalism, which they wanted nothing to do with. They were different. They were the new enterprise culture.
Pause.
He was the sort of person who was...
Just to take up on that thought, actually. I mean, first of all, it's interesting the sort of the comparison with Trump there, isn't it? You know, the guy that can't be controlled in the system representing the threat. And you know, what you know, we were saying last week in Milken's video about, you know, reality and perception. And this is the sort of era of this rebranding, as I talked about the communications classes rising up. You've got this, it's now new enterprise. It's the banks doing the same old kind of corporate, if you like, you know, sacking and thuggery. But it's being sanitized with this sort of Thatcherite rhetoric of aspiration and freshness, because you're undergoing an economic moment where there's a replacement of the kind of nuts and bolts, heavy bulk manufacturing businesses, more with a kind of approach to the economy, which is about the customized lifestyle industry, retail. You know, as the 80s draw on, you know, it's about you're getting your Pog and Pole kitchen and your Bang & Olufsen hi-fi and your Range Rover.
Kind of reminds me of some of the rhetoric we hear now. When we do stuff, that's liberal democracy. When you do stuff, that's a threat to democracy. And this is like, well, when you do stuff, that's the unacceptable face of capitalism. When we do stuff, that's enterprise.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. So this is a familiar figure, this guy on the screen, and all the others, these you know, merchant bankers and financiers we see. You get a strong sense in these last couple of episodes anyway of they're sort of squirming a bit. They're trying to justify this and say, well, I wouldn't put it like that, you know.
Yeah, none of them seem to know what they're supposed to say. Am I supposed to be positive about this stuff or not? It is interesting.
Seem to be thought to be involved in corrupt ways, and ever since the Edward Heath statement in Parliament about the unacceptable face of capitalism and that sort of thing, he seemed to be, in the words of 1066 and all that, a bad thing. Unreliable character and questionable motivation. An inappropriate owner of such a crown jewel. Couldn't trust the fella.
The banks did everything they could to...
I mean, it is interesting that in the free market economy of Thatcher, you basically had the establishment saying, you're an unacceptable owner. We cannot allow you to own Harrods, because that's not really a free market, is it?
Not at all. That's treating Harrods as basically a national asset, isn't it?
Stop Roland. They persuaded the government to refer his bid to the Monopolies Commission. One of the few other companies that Roland owned in Britain was a firm that made nylon bedsheets called Brentford Nylons. The commission argued that if Roland bought Harrods, he would then have a monopoly on the sale of nylon bedsheets in Britain. So they blocked the bid. It was an absurd ruling, but the government accepted it.
Well, I thought it was totally absurd. And the city press thought it was totally absurd. And Tiny thought it was that the true motivation was they didn't like him. And nothing would persuade him after that that the true reason was not the reason given, but simply a matter of personal animus. They didn't want Tiny to have House of Fraser.
Roland knew that he had been stopped because of his corrupt past. He was furious because to him it was the height of hypocrisy. Roland knew that underneath the new shiny enterprise culture, there was a growing mass of corruption. Corruption on a far grander scale than anything he had indulged in.
I became a fraud squad officer sort of 1980, 1981. And within a very, very, very short space of time, I became utterly amazed at the level and the degree and the volume of fraud that we were being asked to investigate and uncover. At a time when this climate of enterprise that had been unleashed by the politicians had just really started to get into its stride, wherever you looked, there was this tide of sleaze. But of course, nobody thanked you for bringing this to the fore. Nobody wanted to discuss this. We saw avenues of investigation being blocked, prosecutions not being proceeded with. The Director of Public Prosecutions not proceeding with certain kinds of prosecutions, using the phrase, well, it's not, I mean, sometimes they would say, well, it's not in the public interest. There was this enormous sense that as long as the markets are given free rein, we don't want to do anything that would be seen to stand in their way.
All of us in politics have dreams. It's part of mine to give power and responsibility back to people. Popular capitalism is a crusade to enfranchise the many in the economic life of Britain. And that is the kind of society I want to see.
We'll pause that. Politics became compromised by the power that was unleashed by the new climate event.
Just want to say about that it's an interesting thing that she does there in that speech. She talks about, you know, we want to, you know, empower people. But she's sort of smuggling in a problem for the political formula, I think. It's people, she's saying. But really what she's conflating it with is the wealth creation class. She's not talking about the masses of the washed up, redundant and unemployed in the country. She's talking about the wealth creation class. And so the idea of the people, that political formula, as you usually say, political formulas cannot brook an and. So she's not talking about, you know, creating wealth for everybody in Britain. She's talking about creating wealth for the wealth creation class. I mean, I don't want to get terribly Marxist here, but, you know, you can't have the wealth creating class and working class people. It's just one set of people that she's talking about. You know, do you understand what I'm saying?
Do you want to come back on that, Horace?
Why can't you have both?
Well, you can't have both. I'm talking about, that's her political formula. Her political formula is, we're going to create wealth for people. But it's a kind of a definition of people that's a little bit compromised by the fact she's only really talking about these popular capitalists, which is not going to be everybody in a society like Britain, is it?
All right, I see. I've seen her using that phrase elsewhere, and I think, I mean, I'm basing this on how the documentaries I watched connected it, but I think she's also referring to the freedom to buy shares in what used to be state monopolies like British Gas and British Telecom and stuff. I think that was at least one of the main components of popular capitalism. Are you referring to...
It's more her overall conception that she's selling there is that this is open to everybody. She's talking about the people being able to acquire wealth. But what I'm saying is actually she's really talking about a subset of the people as such.
Because some people won't take those opportunities or can't.
Well, a lot of people probably won't, yeah. But yeah. Her political formula rests on that. And it means, yeah, I'm really just talking about the wealth-creating class, not them and everybody else. Perhaps one of the difficulties of her legacy.
So like people who, you know, are happily just working for the NHS for their whole lives, they're not going to, this is going to be meaningless to them. Is that what you mean?
Largely, yeah. I mean, I'm thinking in terms of AA's political formulas that cannot, you know, you cannot have an and. It's one set of people or another set of people.
I mean, how Thatcher would probably justify this is in two ways. The first way is that, like, well, the wealth creators will actually create jobs, which will give more normal people
trickle
wealth,
down economics, yeah.
Right. So there's that. That's the one thing. And the other thing she'll say is that, in fact, Boris Johnson used to talk like this quite a lot, where it's the analogy of the cake, right? So the cake keeps on in her system, in under capitalism, the cake keeps on getting bigger. Right. And so, okay, you'll get some people who have very large slices of that, but there's still more cake and there's more cake for everyone. Therefore, that's the roundabout way that they justify it. I don't know if you agree with that, Horace, but it seems to me that this is just like basic libertarian talking points.
Yeah, I think they're right. I think they do think that, and they'd be right to think that. I don't know if what Johnson did in government or any of those guys would actually conduce to what he's proclaiming, but, yeah, in a market, you would expect much, much more wealth to be created. Yeah. Just talking of in terms of what she said about popular capitalism, if say there was an industry like, say, public transport, that's a bad example, terrible example. What an industry that went from being straightforwardly state controlled to being just part of the market. I can't think of a good example now, but in such an area, it was like illegal to provide this good or service if you weren't the state monopoly, right? If that ends and now private providers are allowed to do it and someone sets up a business and then they begin to employ 1, 2, 3, 4 people, that is genuinely new job creation. So that is growing, if you like, the cake. And it's also arguably adding, right? It's not taking a slice from the cake, it's actually adding a slice in a sense, right? So part of what these sort of free market guys say is true. But they will always also elide the destruction, the creative destruction, you could say. But they tend, obviously, well, you know, everything they're advocating. You know, if you had a state monopoly that was employing 100,000 people, and then when you make it private and you find out you only need 30,000, yeah, there's undeniably going to be loads of people fired. It's a lot of phenomena happening at once.
But those jobs will be reallocated. Those people will be reallocated to more productive ends. Right,
like presumably, yeah. I mean, the market does not make predictions, as it were. You know, in that sense, it doesn't account for those people either. It doesn't say, "I have something for you. But observation and theory do point that way, that where you have a market, yeah, people do get jobs. Like, yeah. And if they don't, it's usually because they're being prevented by the state.
I mean, it's basically just supply side economics, Say's law is what we're talking about here.
And an aversion to state socialism, to state monopolies, a desire to end most of that. Although Thatcher's governments never did anything about state education, state health, and so on and so on.
But just to explain very quickly, this is the theory now, Simon. I'm not saying this is actually what happens, but the theory would be that, let's take the scenario, the guy is now operating something that used to be done by the state. Now he's got his own business. He employs, let's say, 20 people. Okay. Each of those 20 people now have disposable income. They all also have things that they need, right? So their demand for stuff will actually produce even more opportunities. Let's say each one of them needs to have a sandwich to eat every day for lunch. Well, that is now an opportunity for some enterprising, what was the Harry Enfield character? Paulos. Maybe Paulos can open the Greek sandwich store on the corner. And now there's a restaurant, and now he can employ so many people, and they need things. And lo and behold, now you've got a barber down the street where there was nothing before, and so on and so forth. And that is basically the kind of Say's law free market dream, something like that.
Enterprise. Thatcher and Tebbit had seen this sort of road to the New Jerusalem through freedom of markets, and had unleashed it and had let it loose without, I think, without realizing the kinds of all the sort of dangerous and damaging spin-offs that would happen.
But then suddenly, the Thatcher government came face to face with one of the other effects of deregulating the financial markets. And this time, it was an effect they couldn't ignore.
25-26 the market. 25-26 the market at the moment.
At the end of 1984, the government faced its first big currency crisis. Speculators on the international markets began to sell pounds and buy dollars because of high interest rates in the United States. There was nothing the government could do to stop them, and they watched helplessly as the pound slid to almost $1 on the foreign exchanges. And then it got worse. The richest man in the world, the Sultan of Brunei, announced that he was going to shift £10 billion to America. Mrs. Thatcher faced disaster. She turned for help to the Sultan's representative in London. She sent her private secretary, Charles Powell, to see him.
Margaret Thatcher, during the crisis, she knows that the Sultan of Brunei is a friend of mine.
Pause, please.
Charles Powell coming.
Go on.
Excuse me. Sorry. It doesn't explain. I'm not quite clear. Why was this a crisis? Like a lot of times and places, certainly now, and well, yeah, a lot of our lifetime and probably before, but a lot of politicians, almost all leftist politicians, and a lot of Tories as well, they prefer a weak currency. Because it's it makes your exports relatively cheaper, right? A strong currency obviously helps you import, but most people, even though they call themselves free marketeers or whatever, they still actually do believe in some degree of mercantilism because they're statists and because they're thinking of the stability of the state, and mercantilism being as in you want to sell, you don't want to be buying from abroad, you want to be more selling and gold coming in, right? It's an old theory, but like in this occasion, somehow it's the reverse. Somehow that's a massive problem. Was it just the suddenness of it, or what? Like, I don't understand. But, this helps British exports. So why was that a crisis? Does anybody know?
I don't. I'm afraid. My mind went to the same place actually, Horace. Like, why is it such a problem that the pound is dropping versus the dollar? But it could be that the suddenness of the change would have messed up a ton of supply chains on the producer side. And suddenly your costs have doubled because they're buying in dollars or Deutschmarks, whatever it would have been at the time. So it could cause a big producer. If you've got a factory here that's buying parts from abroad, that could screw you over in a hurry if the exchange rate suddenly changes.
Speaking of that, if another documentary I might recommend to people is, unfortunately, it's not all on YouTube. I think part of it's just in Dutch or something, but it's called The Money Changers. And it's about, it includes episodes like this, I think, but I need to watch it again. And it's about, yeah, the differences of international currency arrangements from sort of the 40s up till when the program was made in the 90s, leading up to when the euro was created. And I know that the 80s, even though there was a change in economic thinking, there was also, there was the attempt to converge European currencies upon what would become, yeah, the euro in the first place. Before they actually launched the euro as a currency, there was a period of convergence before that. And this may have been to do with that. It may well have been a crisis because Britain was not locked in, but agreed in to a certain currency arrangement with several other European states. I think that was the case. There was the so-called currency snake. That was one thing. And in the mid-80s, there was also some moment, this may be what they're referring to here, there was a moment where there was several European countries at once. I can't remember what they called it, but they all agreed to do something in response to the American, the dollar's strength, I think. But I'm afraid the name has left me. If anybody could put it in the chat, that'd be helpful.
Just before we get back to this, I have to comment on the fact that Al-Fayed here, we were talking about the penguin as a villain earlier on. This dude is such like a villain. Like, do you remember like Tintin, like the kind of evil Arab sort of Tintin? there's something about Al-Fayed that's got real gangster energy about him. So, you know.
Just the chat have been helpful. A couple of people said Soros caused this crisis that Thatcher's referring to here.
I think this is later, isn't it? The well, 87.
Soros was 92.
Soros' attack that drove Britain out of the ERM, the European Exchange Rate Mechanism, was in 92. Yeah, Black Wednesday, right? But Soros, that was the nth time Soros had done that. He did it to the Italian currency just before. And yeah, this is what? Is this mid to late 80s that we're at now?
It's just past 87, aren't we?
This is 87. Okay, so that's the same year as there was a massive stock market panic as well. Right? There was that Black Monday or Black Thursday or something. Mm. And yeah, so I think Soros had been doing that thing of attacking currencies. And he was like, this currency is rated too high against that one. I'm going to prove that rating is ridiculous. That, however, you can only do when governments have committed to fixing their currencies at a certain exchange rate against each other, which was part of the preparation for the ERM. Yeah, Soros actually attacked the ERM. Can you believe that? Soros, the arch proponent of the ERM.
That's how he's got like literally unlimited money to spend on stuff now.
That's how he got into the tens of billions, yeah.
Yeah. Mm. Just one brief note as well on the Powells that Al-Fayed's referring to. Charles Powell, he actually pronounces his name Powell, was Thatcher's consigliere.
But his brother is Powell,
yeah, and he advised Tony Blair. So a little bit of dynastic deep state connection there.
I mean, he could literally be a character from The Godfather or something like that, couldn't he? He's just so larger than life. But anyway, let's carry on.
You meet several times to my residence in Park Lane. Please, can you help us? Because we're going to take the reserves, about 10 billion sterling, to one of the American banks. Can you help us? I took the plane. I stayed 2 weeks begging the Sultan. He accepted. I came back, called Charles Powell. He came to see me. I said, it's okay. The funds are not going to be moved. He was so happy. And then he say, Margaret Thatcher is very grateful. And please, in the next visit, when the Sultan comes here, you are invited to have a chat with her to the Downing Street. I say, fine.
Pause. Mohammed Al-Fayed now became an influential.
Yeah, like Mohammed Al-Fayed's like Philip Tattaglia. And you think you're dealing with him. And then in the car on the way back from the meeting with the five families, he says, Al-Fayed's a pimp. I never knew until now that it was the Sultan of Brunei all along. But what was that name he said? Did he say something like Paul Schatzbaum or something? What was that name he said? Somebody's arranged some money in New York. I missed that. Oh, that's an interesting detail.
Didn't I mean, I know it comes a bit later, but didn't Diana start like going out with his son or something?
Dodie.
Yeah.
And they died together.
Yeah.
A bit later than this, but yeah.
And that was considered to be really embarrassing, wasn't it, for the Windsors or something? I'm not sure, but
yeah.
So people cite that as a possible reason why they were bumped off.
What, because he was going out with Dodie Alfayette?
Because he was an Arab, yeah. Or yeah, I mean, some people say because he was an Arab, or maybe because Fayed was considered too dirty a character to be married in.
Yeah, like it's like marrying into the Penguins family or something. to keep on coming back to
that. Which would you, if the Windsors are to marry into either the Penguin or the Penguin archetype, which should it be? I'll leave that one for the chat. There we go.
Figure. He was invited to dinner at number 10. Fayed had made his money out of the oil price rise in the 70s. He had been a middleman, arranging enormous contracts in the Middle East. But now, in the new unstable world of global currency flows, British politicians...
So, sorry to interrupt. Was that David Frost, the TV presenter? Pretty sure that was David Frost talking. Let's go back a little tiny bit. Come on. I think it's David Frost. Watch this now.
He was invited to dinner at number 10. Fayed had made his money out of the oil price rise in the 70s. He had been a middle...
That is David Frost.
Yeah, yes, it does look like him.
Man, good afternoon. Arranging enormous contracts and...
Hello, good evening and welcome.
There you go.
What was he doing there? David Frost, a major power broker in Thatcher's Britain.
Do you know, but Thatcher apparently used to like to meet various people, like including people who disagreed with her. On Sunday evenings, apparently, she used to have just, like, she would let someone like Charles Powell select people to bring her, and they'd be, like, presented to her. But it wasn't that formal. You know, it was a bit formal. Like, people like Ian McKellen was one of them, for some reason. Yeah, so maybe David Frost. But David Frost was really famous, wasn't he? He was like an international star, I think.
Well, he made his name doing the Frost, the Nixon interview. And yeah. With
early that was Python, the week that was in the 60s.
Yeah. Early Python and stuff like that. But yeah. I guess he was still, even just before he died, they'd give him very big interviews or lots of respect and stuff like that. So I suppose he was a part of the British establishment, wasn't he? So.
He was like Wogan, but more serious.
Yeah, like a highbrow Wogan.
And he never did that tune, the Jungle Dance or whatever.
Michael Parkinson for like... president or something like that. I don't know.
The Middle East. But now, in the new unstable world of global currency flows, British politicians needed someone like Fayed. He had a new kind of power, the power of international money.
It would be very hard to think of Mr. Macmillan, Sir Alec Douglas Hume, even I think Edward Heath, giving Mohammed Fayed the time of day. They wouldn't even have received him at number 10. The imagination boggles at the idea that somebody of Mr. Al-Fayed's, what shall we say, background would have had the red carpet rolled out for him. Now suddenly, a person who can be of assistance in adjusting the pressures of the financial international community on a sovereign government becomes, in a way, a player in his own right. He becomes somebody who makes the wheels go round, and you either let him down there with his lubrication, or perhaps you hit the buffers.
And Mohammed Al-Fayed now claimed his reward, Harrods. In early 1985, he made a takeover bid, and a grateful government waved it through without a murmur.
Tiny Roland's just absolutely fuming at this. How could he do this? He'd be thinking, you know. I mean, the country is called selling out in Britain by the pound under Margaret Thatcher. I mean, what is this other than that?
No honour among thieves.
Fayed paid £570 million in cash. The government did nothing to question where the money came from or even whether it was legally his. They accepted the guarantees of an eminent merchant bank, Kleinmort Benson. The bank also had no idea where the money came from. They accepted Fayed's assurances that it was legally his money. And in turn, they received a huge fee.
I think Fayed was as honest and he succeeded in making those elements in the establishment permit themselves to be used as tools through greed and lack of scrupulousness. I think it showed that here is this outsider who should have had every disadvantage, was able by the manipulation of monetary forces to get to the very top, helped and aided by senior city firms who should never have done anything of the kind.
Tiny Roland now swore revenge. He was furious that Fayyad had got the very thing that he wanted. He saw it as evidence that the Thatcher government was now at the mercy of the forces they had unleashed, the powerful global markets, and a corrupt city of London who would do anything for money. He wrote Thatcher a letter accusing her of corruption and announced publicly in the Times, "I will not go away. You will see me in your dreams. You will need to take two Mogadon rather than one to get to sleep at night."
I just love this supervillain energy this guy's got. He's just like, "I will not be thwarted." Mm-hmm. I love it.
In June 1987, Mrs. Thatcher was triumphantly re-elected for a third term. But almost immediately, Britain was hit by an economic crisis that was to turn yet another aging tycoon against her.
Good evening. It is a day that will be in bold print in history books. Black Monday, October 19th, 1987, when the stock market went into a free fall.
The crisis began in New York. A wave of panic swept through the stock market that shares, which had risen continuously for the past 4 years, were overvalued. A contagion of fear infected the world's markets. The next morning, when the London Stock Exchange opened, it immediately fell by 20%.
The sense on the floor, on our trading floor, yeah, it was doom and gloom. It's the end of the world. That was the big phrase. The end of the world, mate, this is it. Blood on the street. It was total sense of helplessness. There's nothing anyone could do. You can't control billions and billions of dollars worth of money. If the markets think the market is going to go down, it will go down. Governments are absolutely powerless.
Governments watched helplessly as the crisis rolled around the world. One after another, stock markets crashed. To many, it seemed as if governments, like Mrs. Thatcher's, had, through deregulation, created a force that was now overwhelming them. One of those who now became frightened was James Goldsmith. Since the crisis of the 70s, he had lived in America. He had made a fortune, asset-stripping corporations and manipulating the markets. But now he decided that the very thing that had made him rich had become a threat to world stability.
I think our financial system is extremely fragile. I think that you can see it in the way the volatility of currencies. You can see all sorts of weaknesses. I believe that the politicians, right, unthinkingly have created a situation, a structure, whereby our financial system is dangerous and could create great problems for the real economy.
Goldsmith now gave up business and retreated to the remote Mexican jungle.
I just love how Bond villainy these guys are. It's just like, yeah, he'd had enough and retreated to his jungle lair. I love it. I'd love to be able to have a jungle lair. Maybe one day when I'm rich enough, I can sell up the lodge and have an Amazonian kind of fortress.
There's actually something in related to this, because when I did the King Arthur stream recently, it came up with a bit of Welsh, you know, sort of Arthurian lore. And there was a character called Myrddin Hwelt, who was around in the 6th century, who was a bard. And after there was a battle called the Battle of Arthderyd, he fled to the forest to live with the beasts, so to speak. And he became this kind of mad inspired prophet living in the wilderness. And you can always sort of see Goldsmith is kind of like this character. I mean, Myrddin Hwelt is, of course, the character that becomes Merlin in later mythologies.
He used his fortune to begin building a vast private estate. He specifically designed it to be a self-sufficient community. It would be a world under his control.
Mexico was his dream, but like other dreams, there's also a reality.
Edward Epstein.
No relation. He was a journalist who was very much read about conspiracy stuff, apparently. Wrote a lot about the JFK assassination conspiracy and other things.
Look at the state on him. His hair and his eyebrows. Terrible look, Edward Epstein.
Living in a classic clinical apartment, sort of.
Yeah.
Hard, soulless New York.
Often conflicts with a dream, and things happen that weren't supposed to happen. Sometimes the bottling plant for the water got contaminated, or sharks got into his private beach and had to be chased away with dynamite, or the mosquitoes couldn't be controlled ecologically by being eaten by birds, so they had to use DDT. That's not what he wanted. What he wanted was a
great callback from Curtis back to the DDT. Do you remember Pandora's Box? Yeah. They were eating the DDT. Remember?
I loved that. What was it? You started off a debate after that one. Should you drink the DDT?
Well, then there was a dude just eating it like cornflakes. Do you remember?
And is it actually harmless? Sorry, this is another topic. Don't worry.
A perfect biosphere where everything lived together in harmony. It was the golden age. Going back to a time in history where we didn't have all the problems.
Goldsmith's estate was dominated by an enormous domed palace on a cliff above the ocean. Around it were houses for his wife, his past wives, and his mistress.
This is amazing. This is like Citizen Kane, Coleridge, you know.
In Xanadu.
It's amazing.
Brilliant. Yeah, I want a bigger dome than St. Paul's. Just get it done.
The estate was guarded by an army of ex-SAS soldiers. They were organised by Colonel David Stirling, Goldsmith's friend from his time in Mayfair in the 60s. Goldsmith's views became more and more apocalyptic. He began to see everything, from AIDS to mad cow's disease, as products of a global economy which the governments had lost control of.
His brother brought up to him the danger of mad cow's disease. He suddenly saw this as this another part of his apocalyptic world where mad cow's disease would break out because cows, as he pointed out, their hoofs were used in making all the gelatin caps on all the pharmaceutical products. So even if you were a vegetarian, you might wind up, you know, and so he became very concerned with this.
But things didn't go the way Goldsmith feared. The global economy didn't collapse. In fact, within 18 months, it had bounced back. The boom started again, driven upwards by a frenzy of speculation around the world, and no one quite understood why. But it was an ideal time to do takeovers, and Goldsmith was tempted out of retirement to try for one last deal. In 1989, he returned to London to announce a bid for the giant British American Tobacco Corporation. The old asset stripper was going to do what he had done so many times before: break it up, sell off large parts, and make himself a fortune. He called it liberating the company.
It is taking companies which are being stifled under the bureaucracy of a large conglomerate and liberating them.
The men whose support Goldsmith needed to succeed in his bid were the anonymous managers who ran the pension funds. But this time, they refused to back him. The truth was that they were now so powerful, they no longer needed people like him anymore. Over the past decade, the pension funds had grown enormously, and they now dominated the stock market. Through it, they owned over 70% of British industry. Their one and only aim was to increase the returns for their pensioners.
Pause, please.
In the past...
God.
That's just interesting. What does he mean that all, like, of 70% of the stock held on the stock exchange was held by pension funds? Does that mean, like, if you looked at the ownership, if you could see the whole 100%, if you looked at an ownership breakdown of, you know, all the everyone who owns more than 1% or whatever, you would see that 70% of that total was owned in, like, across the whole stock market was owned by pension funds. I don't know. Is that right? That seems like a hell of a lot. But it's not like, I mean, when I've looked at ownership of companies, it's nowhere near that. But I'm talking about in the 2000s, 2010s. I think he's probably been a bit.
It's near about 45% BlackRock, 45% Vanguard.
Right. That's what you do see.
State Street, you know.
Yeah, so you see those, and they're investment managers, they include pension funds and also just, you know, stock exchange indexes and stuff. I don't think so. He's exaggerated there. I think what he means is that there was not really much need for these aggressive raider figures. I assume that's what he means, that companies like that, the mode of operating that they had pioneered had become normal. I'm guessing that's what he's saying. And pension funds themselves were just beginning to acquire and tear apart things to get the value.
Because they had the shares, yeah.
Yeah, I don't think they owned 70%, but like they were so important by then. And it's the likes of BlackRock and stuff increasingly since as well.
Well, it could be that if you have a look at market purchases at that time, it was 70%. They were making 70% of the purchases. Not that they had 70% ownership of all of the shares in the adult economy or something like that.
Yeah, unless there's just hundreds of pension funds that are all making up a small percent, but it does amount to 70%. But I don't think so.
That could be.
Yeah. I did just want to pick up on one other thing as well. Like just the sort of portrayal of the economy over those few years that Curtis said was pretty kind of slapdash, right? So he said, obviously, he showed us that currency panic that Thatcher had to deal with that brought in Fayed and Brunei. That happened, it seems, earlier in the year before Black Monday, which was a massive stock market crash. So you got a sterling crash of some kind. And then you've got, so interest rates are really high in America, and yet the stock market was high. That's unusual. Usually high interest rates make people more inclined to save rather than invest in higher risk things like stocks and commodities and so on. And then obviously that crashed as well, presumably while they still had high interest rates. Or maybe there was some measure to bring down American interest rates or to level them compared to other European states. I'm not sure, but Curtis, unfortunately, he's always vague and sort of breezes through stuff like that, and he just sort of characterizes it in not very helpful ways. But a better documentary would have explained those things.
Just interesting on that footage there to see that Goldsmith on his British American Tobacco acquisition was working with Kerry Packer, another man with a sort of gangster physiognomy and a face like something out of Lord of the Rings.
And also, if you believe in nominative determinism, the perfect name to own a cigarette factory, Packer.
They had always backed raiders like Goldsmith because they increased profits by sacking workers and selling off anything that didn't make a profit. But now, the pension funds had learnt they could do this themselves.
We showed to the pension funds you could increase the returns to pensioners. If you sacked 1,000 workers and you got rid of their salaries and wages from the profit and loss account, it would have a dramatic effect on the share price. Share price could go up 3 or 4 times. Which is all the pension fund is interested in. And they did it for a purpose, which was to increase the income to the pensioners.
Pause.
So the pension fund industry were the final arbiters, if they didn't.
Yeah, so I spoke a bit too soon, but it looks like basically pension funds were having a lot bigger say in management, and they were preferring managers who would come in, especially in conglomerated companies, which I think existed a lot until the 80s in Britain. There was like GEC and ICI and GEC, I think, was a classic conglomerate like Berkshire Hathaway is. It just doesn't really do anything itself. It just owns other companies, but lots of them. So you got this trend towards disaggregating conglomerates. I think that's sort of what's really been described here. That ceased to be, at least in their eyes, an efficient way of owning assets that undervalued them, and therefore you tear it apart, you disaggregate them, and they become worth more in their own right. Or those that don't obviously get destroyed.
Like what you were doing, you wouldn't succeed.
The pension funds discovered they could asset strip companies themselves without the need for takeovers, because they already owned the majority of shares. And they now proceeded to do this throughout British industry on a vast scale. They closed factories and downsized thousands of workers. The resulting devastation was irrelevant to them, because the only thing that mattered for the pension funds was the increased return for the pensioners.
They went on because the only thing at the end of the day that mattered to a pension fund manager was the share price performance. I'm afraid the morality of what lay behind it was a consideration that certainly wasn't uppermost in his mind.
Do you blame the pension fund manager for that?
Not directly. I think it's an inevitable consequence of a free market, rather than to attribute specific blame to pension funds.
So the pension fund managers had also become trapped?
By the free market mechanism, yes. Yes.
Pause. So was anyone in control of this process?
Sorry, I said pause too early, but it's what I said last week. It's like often the very worst advocates for the market are businessmen. They are happy to assign to it all the worst characteristics that socialists do. They just agree to all that. They just go, but you just got to put up with it. That's just the way, you know, there's no other way. It's a terrible defense of the market. They're not trying to defend the market. They're actually offloading the responsibility for their own actions onto the market, wrongly. Mm.
A lot of guilty body language as well with this guy. If you watch the clip again after this, his hands is doing a sort of low-key sort of hand-washing, sort of assuaging himself of guilt.
He reminds me of a character from a horror movie, like a Hammer horror. Just imagine turning up at his mansion, you know, you rang. there's something about it. There's that kind of vibe about him. But
process by now.
No.
James Goldsmith went back to Mexico, defeated by a corporation that was more frightened of the pension funds than it was of him. In his anger, he now turned on the politicians. He became convinced that they had let loose something that had gone out of control. The markets, driven by the big institutions, were devastating society, all in the pursuit of an ever higher share price. Goldsmith conveniently forgot that this was exactly what he had been doing for 30 years.
If, purely for an economic doctrine, you have a situation whereby the economy grows, but you create poverty, unemployment, and you destabilize the society, you're in trouble. Look what's happened in the last 50 years. You see, people are not willing to look at fundamentals. When I was a boy, we were taught that irreversibly we were moving towards progress.
Yes.
That material wealth, material prosperity would solve our problems, would improve our way of life, and improve our civilization. And what have we done? We've destabilized our society. We've increased unemployment massively. We've totally destabilized our cities. Therefore, something must be wrong. And what has become wrong is that instead of the economy being there to serve us, we are there adoring, serving economic industries.
But meanwhile, the boom just carried on growing. The vast amounts of money flooding out of the city of London helped to create a consumer boom. And riding on the crest of this wave of money was the new owner of Harrods.
And also a very special guest, someone I want you to make yourself feel at home here, chairman of Harrods.
Has it been a good day so far?
Wonderful, wonderful. We hope, I think, we're going to make £10 million a day.
It's £10 million a day?
Today, £10 million we start, and we have £100 million of goods. And fantastic bargain.
How is Richard Gere? Is he okay?
Was fantastic. I tried to get him here, as a matter of fact, but he preferred
he's
to go to the bed.
By people.
No, he preferred to go to the bed departments because we have the greatest collection of hamsters. And he enjoys.
I really don't know what you're talking about.
No,
at all.
Not at all.
Absolutely baffled here.
Pause. Muhammad Al. You can't imagine Tiny Roland, for all his other faults, you can't imagine him being quite so vulgar about how much money was being made on the first day, let alone referencing Richard Gere's bedroom activities.
I'd have loved to have seen the Tiny Roland Adam Nick review, though. Just to see
but you know, it's there as well. Richard Gere was Fired's guest there, and yet he was still happy to mention the hamster thing.
Yeah, kind of. It is kind of vulgar, to be honest.
Fired was now a rich and successful businessman. He epitomised the enterprise culture created by the Conservative government. He had also been accepted into society. Harrod sponsored the Windsor Polo Championships, and Fayard presented the prize himself to Prince Charles. There was only one problem, though. Tiny Roland. Roland wanted vengeance. The chairman of Roland's company was Sir Edward Ducan. He was a Tory MP, and he was continuously attacking Fayard in Parliament, calling him a liar and a crook. So Fayard decided to fight back. He employed a lobbyist, Ian Greer. Fayard paid Greer to get MPs to defend him in Parliament.
Yeah,
I love this. Raw politics. Raw friend-enemy politics. Love it.
He put questions in the House of Commons. If somebody put question against me, they answer these questions and put also my side of the story. You fight fire with fire, I told you.
Did you pay them money?
Of course. How can they do the job for me? Of course, free? No. This is their fees, right? Guerrier being paid, and they are paid, plus they asking for so many things. And this is normal, you know, practices. If someone asks you to give him something, to do something for you, fine.
The world that Greer took Fayard into was a hidden one that he and a few other lobbyists had created. They had turned politics into a business. Greer represented scores of large corporations and newly privatized companies. All of them wanted to exert pressure on Parliament. And Greer knew that in the new climate of enterprise, MPs would be eager to help, provided the companies offered them favors in return.
I played a major part in making sure that commercial interests were better understood by government ministers and members of Parliament. For that, I make no apology at all.
Better understood. I've got to love the language games they play.
Yeah, that is how lobbyists describe themselves, isn't it?
I'm just providing a service so that the politicians understand what it is the businesses want. Yeah.
In the process, expectations were raised, perhaps by me unconsciously, perhaps by my clients, that there is a honeypot here and you can partake of that.
Yeah.
And I think that...
yeah, that happened unconsciously.
Yeah.
It's like taking a, you know, the trough for the pigs to have a bit of their swill, you know.
But I didn't make the trough. I didn't make the meat from it.
I just happened to have left a trough there, you know.
This culture certainly demonstrated itself in the behaviour of some members of Parliament who did take advantage of their position and did become greedy. I think Neil Hamilton is a prime example. There are many others.
Fayard did what Greer's other clients did. He gave MPs like Neil Hamilton favours in return for questions. He also went further. He says that he gave MPs cash, although Neil Hamilton denies this. In the process, Fayard, along with Greer's other clients, was transforming the very nature of politics. The politicians had created a vast boom through
So I think there's like a common misconception that Neil Hamilton was, you know, like he was obviously, this was a scandal in a way, but I don't think he broke the law. I don't think, not even nearly. I don't think this was a prohibited practice. This thing of taking money for asking questions, like it was Fayard personally doing it in Neil Hamilton's case, and in the other case it was loads of businesses and stuff. Apparently that was legal. What went wrong for Hamilton was that he tried to sue Fayard for saying, I think he sued Fayard for talking about it, or the way he described it or something. But once again, there's an interesting set of videos about this on YouTube, if anyone wants to have a look. It's by Jonathan Boyd Hunt, who is like a sort of local journalist who, for whatever reason, became really ardently pro-Hamilton and like spent, I think he's just sort of, I don't know, left journalism and just became a one-man defender of Neil Hamilton. I don't know why. But I started watching these very long series of videos on this, and it seems to be true. seems to be that Neil Hamilton didn't do anything wrong, or what he did wrong was actually really peripheral, just sort of basically being a bit dishonest about things after the truth or something, after the fact. I'm not sure, but what he's thought of as, like, he's thought of as this particularly corrupt MP, and obviously Martin Bell gave that impression, right? It's not really true. It's that the whole Tory party were doing this, and obviously Labour does it with the trade unions, with Islamic groups, and so on, you know, like, loads of MPs are just on the take all the time. But Neil Hamilton handled it badly, or was just someone... The other thing is the BBC, and especially The Guardian, seem to have decided to take him down. Possibly, like, Jonathan Boyd-Hunt says in his videos that this was basically just to open the way for Blair. It was just this scandal would help destroy John Major's government. And it did so, perhaps.
It sort of deserves a revisitation on its own, because I remember this whole period, the Cash for Questions scandal, and it seemed to have fallen, you know, on the heels of things from, like, the mid-'80s, like the Westland affair, Matrix Churchill, Supergun, Arms to Iraq, all that sort of stuff, sort of succession of death by a thousand cuts scandals that led to this atmosphere of, you know, as they say, Tory sleaze, as it was called.
Which had a lot of factual basis, didn't it? But also, it was helping the left.
Yeah, like, the allegations of Jonathan Aitken about procuring prostitutes for arms deals, Alan Clark being economical with the actualité, you know, that sort of era. It's kind of worth a stream on its own, just revisiting the numerous kind of shenanigans.
And there was Mark Thatcher was a kind of an embarrassing figure as well.
Is Neil Hamilton still the leader of UKIP now?
He's definitely tweeting stuff about them. I looked at him just the other, he follows me on Twitter, by the way. I think he's definitely still tweeting stuff in favour of UKIP. If he's not the leader anymore, he might still be the leader. Obviously, UKIP are tiny now. But yeah, he was, at least until quite recently. I think, like, one other reason why the left, and I include the BBC in that, because obviously the BBC does recruit from The Guardian and stuff. I think they were happy to go after Hamilton in particular because he was the arch Thatcherite. He was like, I mean, he founded that, or was co-founder of that No Turning Back group, which was like, no, Thatcher's a lefty. Like, we've got to, you know, we've got to tear open the NHS, everything, right? He called himself the Praetorian Guard of Thatcherism. So it made sense that they went after him in particular rather than someone like, you know, Kenneth Clark, who's basically their guy in loads of ways. It's actually a more interesting scandal than it seems. And like Simon, I remember the same, like, this was in the news for years, wasn't it? And such a tiny thing compared to a lot of other things. It was in the news for year after
and it
year,
really, for like 5 or 6 years. Absolutely blighted the Major government and led to that atmosphere whereby Blair was just welcomed in as this sort of clean moral agent of social reconstruction with open arms. You know, people
and
just sick of the relentlessness of it.
Yeah, and that was effective. Like, Blair was thought of as, like, clean. Then people have pointed out since, like, there's a guy I read called Sean Gabb, who's a libertarian. There's also Peter Hitchens has written about it. No, the Blair government was outrageously corrupt, but they just got away with it because of the impression that had been successfully created about the Tories. It's like, well, yeah, the Tories are very corrupt, but so are Labour, of course. But who did that job of keeping this in the news for years? It was the BBC above all else.
Regulation. And the lobby industry had become a mechanism for feeding the fruits of that boom back into politics. Politicians wanted to cash in on the very thing they had created.
They want to go in political life, to cash in, to be member, advisors to companies, member of the board of companies. They bullshit people to cash in. And you see all the previous member of parliament or ministers, they are directors in major oil companies, directors in banks, you know, they cash in.
Politics had become a business. Once the Thatcher era was in full swing, if you asked a new Tory MP, can you help me on this? He would say, what's in it for me? I want a directorship and 12,000 quid. I've got to send my child to a private school. So that there became a new cash nexus. The nature of politics changed.
The lobbyists found it easy to buy MPs, not just because politicians were greedy, but because increasingly they were disillusioned. They knew that power had shifted from Parliament to the City of London.
It is a direct result of the diminishing of power of the Member of Parliament. today compared with 20 years ago. There is an attitude that recognizes that, recognizes they haven't got the power that they used to have, and says, we've got to take commercial advantage and every other kind of advantage of the period that we are there. And the power's gone. What else are you going to do?
But Tiny Roland would not give up on his vendetta. He knew that the government had commissioned a report into the Fayyad's takeover of Harrods, but were refusing to publish it. So Roland then did what he was best at. He bribed an official and got hold of a copy of the report. And then he published it. The report said that the Fayyads had lied about where their money came from. To many, it meant they should never have been allowed to buy Harrods.
Good evening. An official Department of Trade report says the Fayyad brothers lied repeatedly to the government, the Office of Fair Trading, and their own board during their successful bid to take over the House of Fraser store chain, which includes Harrods. But the Trade Secretary, Nicholas Ridley, told the Commons it would not be in the public interest to disqualify them from being company directors.
The government's refusal to do anything caused a scandal, and Mohammed Al-Fayyad and his brothers became despised figures. They were attacked in Parliament as crooks and thieves, and the MPs he had paid to defend him said nothing.
A great many of us, both inside this house and far more, I think, outside this house, will feel astonished that he is not now going to take action to disbar those directors of the House of Fraser who have been so seriously criticised in his report.
They have obviously purged their background, and if they and that they should be deported as undesirable aliens. We don't want them here. They're crooks.
even in this time. Still, nobody would be saying that today, would they?
The spirit of the blustering colonel lives on.
I'm guessing like the Daily Express the next day was like, deportations to begin, and then they don't begin.
Mohammed Al-Fayyad retreated to the castle he had bought in Scotland. He was furious. He had been dropped by the MPs he had lavished money and gifts on, and he was being attacked in Parliament for being corrupt. To him, it was gross hypocrisy, because he knew that many MPs were just as bad as he was.
I just really felt betrayed, completely betrayed, completely ungrateful bastards. You know, just you can't just imagine that people can behave like that. You know, I'm a major investor, I'm a major employer. I have 30,000 people working for me. 30,000 people, right? How can they do that? These are the people, you know, because they're trash of the trash, right? This is the problem. And these are the people who are example, the people elect and put in power. It's just devastating. You can't just see how great country like that, with great history, with great civilization, you can just go find yourself ruled by a bunch of crooks, and people have no moral, have no ethics, have nothing.
Fire was...
I don't disagree with it, to be honest.
It's a little bit of myth-making on Fayyad's own terms there, that, you know, these parties in the past, you know, were ruled by decent people. Well, no.
Yeah, when?
Yeah.
When was that?
Fair point.
Was rejected by a society which he knew was doing much worse things than anything he'd ever been accused of and criticised for doing things which he felt were happening throughout the Conservative Party. People were taking money for arms deals, that government ministers were engaged in corrupt practices, and that MPs were taking money to perform favours in Parliament. There was an increasingly corrupt relationship between Parliament and business, which allowed business to bend Parliament to its will.
I just had a thought, though, right? So one aspect of all of this is that, yeah, okay, there's a lot of corruption going on and cash for money and, cash for questions and all this sort of stuff. But you could see that all of those men in that, you know, in Parliament at that time were at least like professionals or former lawyers or, just thinking, like, imagine trying to do business in the House of Commons today if you're Al Fayed, and the person you're having to pay off is Angela Rayner.
Yeah.
Or, yeah. I don't know, like, just imagine, like, the state of the politicians now. How can you do business with them, I wonder?
It's the sense that they were corrupt, but today's lot wouldn't even be competent enough to be corrupt.
Yeah, would you even bother to go to them? Or because this is one of the things that happens in the Blair era, really, is that they just bypass Parliament entirely, just go straight to the tiny little team around Blair, he'd sort it out. You wouldn't need to go to the rest of the party, because he managed to kind of streamline the process, let's just say. So
that,
anyway.
In Blair's case, that will partly be because various MPs are put in Parliament by unions directly, right? I don't know exactly how that works in the Labour Party, workings of the party, but that is a thing. Like, certain MPs are just known to be, that's a Unison guy, he's a GMB guy, and that's that.
That means they can't be bought off, does it? The union.
I'd say they're already bought off, really. They're just working for that union, they're just like not even vaguely representing their constituents or anything, because that's a national thing, obviously, a trade union. But Blair, obviously, his relationship with the unions is he just wants their money and for them to have no say whatsoever in policy. What you said makes sense, I think.
20, Mrs. Thatcher was forced out as leader of the Conservative Party. She was succeeded by John Major. He saw himself as a strong man who was going to reassert control over the markets. Above all, he wanted to prevent the damaging fluctuations in the value of the pound. His solution was to take Britain into what was called the exchange rate mechanism. The value of the pound was fixed to Europe's strongest currency, the Deutschmark. It would no longer be at the mercy of the currency speculators.
All my adult life, I've seen British governments driven off their virtuous pursuit of low inflation by market problems or political pressures. I was under no illusions when I took Britain into the exchange rate mechanism. I said at the time that membership was no soft option. The soft option, the devaluer's option, the inflationary option, in my judgment, that would be a betrayal of our future at this moment. And I tell you categorically, that is not the government's policy.
Do you think Keir Starmer is more boring than John Major? Because Major's whole gimmick was being really dull. I mean, he was pretty dull in that speech there. But
that was a gimmick, you say? That he was just dull, wasn't he?
But do you think Starmer's even more boring than Major?
You can at least feel mildly nostalgic for John Major.
Starmer looks like he's not that well to me. Like, Major doesn't look ill. Like, Starmer looks a bit like sort of a bit soft and flaccid, a bit sort of like his body's like collapsing.
Like he's had one too many like full English or something.
Yeah, and he's got a terrible diet, and just listened too much to the vegans or whatever. I don't know.
Currency markets decided to take on the British government. They deliberately set out to force John Major to devalue and to leave the exchange rate mechanism. It was to be a defining battle over who really now controlled Britain's economy, the government or the markets.
Pause a second.
The market.
Go on.
So obviously he's about to talk about Black Wednesday and Soros, but it's not the economy. We're talking about specifically the exchange rate mechanism. Like, that's not the economy. It's a completely new thing. And it's organised specifically for the purpose of creating a federal European state. It's not a question of markets versus government control of the economy. It's an ambitious and I would say ridiculous project of trying to align all the currency values to merge them into one currency. Like, it's much more specific than what Curtis says.
But I guess the basic point is, though, was there the political will to make this happen, or was some major fluctuation in the market going to ultimately dictate what would happen? Something like this.
Well, the problem is the will was there, but the sense wasn't, So, we could talk all day about Black Wednesday, but essentially it was Major trying to just create a new reality that didn't exist. It's like, we'll just say that the pound is worth this many lira or whatever. And then Soros just said, well, it's not. It's not, look what I'm doing. I'm driving it below the range you said it would exist in. And thus the whole thing just evaporated. And that was that. And then we're not in the euro, thanks to Soros.
It's ironic in a way.
It's also new that if they succeeded, they would make a fortune. They began by selling billions of pounds on the foreign exchanges.
It was incredible. I mean, obviously you can hear what's going on in the market, and you can hear wave after wave of selling hitting the market, being met with resistance and support by the Bank of England. They were buying such a phenomenal amount of pounds.
The only thing the government could do was to tell the Bank of England to raise interest rates. But the markets knew that this was an act of desperation.
We had a fairly strong sense that we were on to the kill. It indicated to us that we are in the end game, that there was no, you know, this was an act of desperation. So instead of restraining us, it was really an invitation to double up, to try to sell as much more as possible. So that afternoon, it became a veritable avalanche. A single government, like the British government, has practically no power in resisting these global powers.
Suddenly the Bank of England wasn't supporting pounds. Instead of a load of noise coming out of the voice brokers and everything and around the dealing room, everyone just sat in stunned silence for about 2 seconds or 3 seconds, and all of a sudden it erupted and sterling just free fell. That sense of awe that the markets could take on a central bank and actually win, I couldn't believe it.
So how many pounds have you sold?
About half a billion.
Half a billion. So has it been good business?
Yeah, it's been really good. Yeah.
What does that mean to the bank here?
We've had an excellent day. We've made a lot of money. So it's good.
What are we talking about? A couple of £100,000?
Probably about 10 million.
To James Goldsmith, this was the evidence that the apocalypse was indeed happening. The global markets were destroying governments. Their next step in world domination, he believed, were the free trade treaties, like GATT and the Maastricht Agreement on Europe. These treaties were being forced on governments by corporations, who in turn were under pressure from the greedy markets. The treaties would give the corporations the freedom to move their factories to wherever labour was cheapest. In the process, treaties would destroy national identities and governments.
Yes. Interesting. Also interesting to see Soros in this light as somebody who wants the primacy of the market and capital over national governments in this way. Because it kind of goes with his open society idea and the destruction of national identity and things like that. Interesting, very interesting.
Who benefits? I'll tell you who benefits.
Well, they'll say...
I'll tell you who benefits. Let me give you the facts. The facts are the people who benefit are the big major corporations. There's a divorce between the interests of major corporations and of society. Now, how do they operate? They're no longer linked to the United States, the American ones, or to France, or to Britain. They operate by farming out their production to whatever country produces the cheapest labor, wherever they can get the biggest return on capital and pay the lowest part to labor. We will create, on a scale unheard of, mass migration. What we saw in Rwanda, 2 million people will be nothing. So as to satisfy an economic doctrine. And the result is we are destroying the stability of our societies because we are worshipping the wrong god, economic index.
He's right. He's right. Look at us now, 30 years later. Look at us.
So it all began to fit together into a very clear picture for him, where everything that had happened since the 15th century, all the economic theories, all the Enlightenment theories, all the Renaissance theories, had all come together to create a false economic system.
Goldsmith now decided to make a stand against the forces of globalism. At the end of 1994, he returned to Britain to announce he was forming his own political party. It had one aim. It would fight at the next general election to force a referendum on the Maastricht Treaty. He was going to give those who didn't want to be ruled by a global business elite the chance to reassert their national identity.
I will help them. I will guarantee that they have the infrastructure to put forward one candidate in each constituency. And I will guarantee that that party will be funded as well as any other political party. To be able to fight that campaign, have a 30-day life, put through the referendum, and then resign.
Goldsmith's announcement caused a sensation. It was seen as a direct attempt to destroy the Conservative vote at the next election. And that very same month, the major government received another body blow from a vengeful tycoon. From their old ally and supporter, Mohammed Al-Fayed.
A government minister resigns over the cash for questions allegations. Tim Smith admitted he accepted money from the owner of Harrods to ask questions in the Commons. The second minister, Neil Hamilton, denies the allegations and is suing for libel.
Doesn't it just show the present frenzy of ludicrous rumours that are sweeping around?
John Major sacks his trade minister, Neil Hamilton, and sets up an inquiry into standards of conduct in public office.
I shall, of course, be registering the biscuit in the Register of Members.
Fayed had been furious when the government refused to give him a British passport. In revenge, he revealed to The Guardian how he had given gifts and money to MPs. Fayed now portrayed himself as a noble fighter against the corruption of Parliament.
This is a gift for me.
He conveniently forgot that he had been one of those who had tempted MPs.
Thank you. Have a nice evening.
The corruption of the political system and the corruption of the people have kidnapped those parties and changed them and changed the principles, right? Because those parties before 30, 40 years ago was ruled by decent and honorable people.
Back in the old days, if you paid someone off, at least they'd, you know,
carry through the deal.
That's a quote. There's an American politician or someone who said that, didn't they? Said the definition of an honest politician is one who stays bought.
I'm ashamed that such a great country and such a great people can just only put trash people to lead them and to guide them, right?
Major's government was rocked by Fayed's revelations. Many of the MPs he had paid and given gifts to had by now become ministers. It showed just how deeply business had penetrated into the heart of politics. And it was a process that was out of control. Even the man who had started it all had become worried.
I think it became very greedy. And advantage taking was very much the order of the day by a substantial number of members of Parliament. I can remember becoming deeply concerned about this whole attitude, the attitude of so many members, that I went to see the Chief Whip with the chairman of the 1922 committee. The Tory backbench parliamentary committee, to say to him, I think that a lot of Conservative members of Parliament are getting out of control. I think they are beginning to actually demonstrate signs of going over the top.
It was also a triumphant moment for Tiny Rowland. He had begun the chain of events that had forced Fayed into his angry exposure of government corruption. He and Fayed were reunited. Both had achieved what they wanted. Vengeance. But in the process, two unscrupulous men had exposed how British politics had been taken over by the power of money.
We both felt time had come.
Amazing supervillain team up here. Tiny Rowland and Fayed. Here we go. It's Tiny like the Joker and the Penguin team up, you know. They just need to get the Riddler on board now.
Tiny Roman's smile there was so like such a super villain smile. Like, it looks like he's grimacing at the same time. He should have a gold tooth, I reckon. It should glint at the right moment as well.
He's got that sort of face carved out of rock, isn't hasn't he?
Yeah, craggy.
For us to get together again and for
and put all the things behind us. You know, which friendship. If the Israeli and the Palestinian can make peace, then the Egyptian and Laurent and Tani Rouen can do, isn't it?
Well, they can't.
They both have ended up by holding up a mirror, or if you like, a magnifying glass.
I think that was the year that Arafat got the Nobel Peace Prize, 1994.
I know, it's this guy in previous episodes was just like a Financial Times columnist, and now it's saying he's a PR advisor to Fayyad.
Well, I mean, Curtis has been slowly building up his portfolio. I'm wondering like how many of these merchant bankers were guys he met making the Nick Leeson documentary, for example. So he does seem to be building up contacts.
The guy who was interviewed earlier, I think he was called Rowan. I've forgotten his name.
Bosworth Davies, the fraud office guy.
Rowan Bosworth Davies.
Yeah. So fraud office. Yeah.
I know someone who invited him to a few events to speak about things like this. Much you know, after the 2008 crash, and he's quite an interesting guy. Outraged by the things he's seen all through his career.
Very interesting.
To our society, and really showing us things that the rest of us didn't know were going on. Mohammed and Tiny were both people who were capable of corruption, but who paid people money, but they ended up telling great truths about our society. They are truth tellers.
30 years before, both wrote...
Again, I just want to heavy-handedly emphasize the Trump comparison, the idea that you have these figures who are these sort of accelerants who kind of reveal the mechanisms of elite competition, a little peek behind the curtain. And yeah. That's the power of
the disruptor. I'm reminded of the moment in the 2015 leaders debate where he says, you know, I know because I've done it. Of course, they're all paid off because I've done it, you know, and who wouldn't? That's the smart thing to do. It's kind of it is interesting.
He made it a selling point as well, didn't he? Brilliantly done.
Ireland and Goldsmith had been part of the Claremont Sat, a group of reckless financial gamblers who had helped awaken the markets and begin their rise to power. But now, both of them, in their different ways, found themselves fighting against the force that they had helped create. When Goldsmith formed the Referendum Party, at its core were many of his old gambling friends from the 60s. Even Jim Slater's son stood as a candidate. Jim Slater was Goldsmith's closest friend. Back in the 60s, the two of them had begun the asset stripping of British industry. And John Aspinall, who had founded the club, also stood as a candidate. He and Goldsmith were trying to recreate a golden age when nations were powerful, not the markets.
The past gave him inspiration, not the future. He was frightened of the future, very frightened of the future.
Isn't it, testament to Adam Curtis's filmmaking here, it's amazing how this, from the start to now, it's come full circle. Have you noticed? That these guys were where the guys that they were taking out in the 60s were at the start, if that makes any sense. They've kind of come, you know, they became the thing that they defeated in a way.
I mean, that's kind of a theme of what Curtis does here. It's this it's a sort of tragic dimension again to these people, that they're sort of taken over by the sort of power and force of what they're trying to do. And then they almost have this sort of last minute realization that they've screwed the pooch. And they have this zeal to kind of overcorrect the thing, you know, because of the sort of fatal blindness they have. It's like the Alec Guinness character in Bridge on the River Kwai. What have I done?
Mm-hmm.
And you see that with Goldsmith.
You see, I have a theory that is the arc that Tony Blair is on. I know everybody disagrees, but yeah. I reckon I truly believe that is why he won't leave it go, because he wants to come back and fix the mess that was made. But anyway, let's carry on.
Future of the world, including England, very, very, very concerned and bemused, I should say, bewildered by the present and his inspiration for what was correct. and adjusted. It always came from the past.
Don't wake up on the 2nd of May to the same old Tories back again. And wake up in May to a new Labour government and new hope and new opportunity for Britain.
There it is, 10 o'clock, and we say Tony Blair is to be Prime Minister and a landslide is likely.
Martin Bell.
Independent.
29,300.
Mallet David, Conservative Party, 17,108.
Zero seats, 1.0 here. Look.
Let's just savor this moment, shall we?
I would like to say that 1,500 votes is a derisory total. And we have shown tonight that the referendum party is dead in the water. And Sir James, you can get off back to Mexico knowing your attempt to buy the British political system has failed.
In May 1997, a Labour government was elected. But far from reasserting power over the financial markets, they did exactly the opposite. To reassure the city, Gordon Brown's first act as Chancellor was to give away the government's last instrument of economic power. He gave control over interest rates to the Bank of England. It was an admission by the Blair government that they couldn't control global economic forces, and there was no point in them trying.
Pause, please.
What is called
That's not the last instrument of government's economic power, obviously, and it wasn't an admission that they can't control the markets. The idea was that if you have a independent, albeit still revocable, board of people deciding interest rates, they'll make better decisions, more long-term thinking decisions than politicians will, which there's an obvious logic to that. It's not really a question of giving away power. Obviously, the government can rescind that. They can just take over and impose direct control over the bank again if they want to. So it's just more of Curtis's nonsense about power.
Do we believe that the Bank of England was independent under Blair and Brown?
Yeah, it's at arm's length. It's not literally independent. It can just be taken back, obviously.
I mean, it was always the Blair special. We're going to set up an independent body to do this.
Mm. You've seen The Thick of It?
Yeah.
You know, the Christmas specials, the character of Julius Nicholson, like the Blair-type PM's legacy is going to be that we're going to kick immigration out of out of politics and just hand it over to an independent expert board. Obviously that didn't happen in real life, but that was it. You know, like let's just assign that to a board, and then it's not political. It's not a political problem anymore. There's no argument over it.
It's a post-political question decided by a panel of quote unquote independent experts.
And like Curtis probably wouldn't know this, but there's been that trend in American politics. Again, Rothbard talks about that in the late 19th century. There was this, and early 20th century, there was this idea of if something's too contentious, just take it out of politics. Now, obviously you can't literally take it out of politics. It just means that all the power goes to one board, you know, but it's a daft idea. But yeah, Curtis has misread this. It's not, they didn't literally give away the power. They thought that it was better managed. Again, it's more like managerialism. They thought it's better managed at arm's length. It's a question of governance, right? It's like corporate governance. Like, it's not just, you know, it's corporate governance helps things work for everybody involved, you know, in the same, you know. So it was carrying corporate ideas over to government in a way.
Globalization is changing the whole nature of the nation state. As power becomes more diffuse and borders more porous. Technological change is reducing the power and capacity of government to control its domestic economy free from external influence.
It'd be totally dishonest of me or anyone to pretend that we can change conditions in a world market which alter the circumstances in which companies operate and trade. We can't do that.
Pause. The Labour government gave away its power
Is that not Blair setting up the inevitability thesis on which he comes to trade? We cannot stop whatever's happening. We're sort of symbolically abandoning Keynesianism. And so, you know, inevitabilities come with that.
As borders become more porous, that's just a thing that's happening.
That's the so is the way Blair talks. It's whatever is happening is inevitable. And in a way, the decision's already been taken. So the only thing that we can do is talk about, you know, with these things accepted, how can we best go about implementing and helping it on its way?
Do we actually see here Curtis falling for Blair's trick in a way, you know? Because Blair is kind of giving the image that he's given away all his power. We're just swimming with the tide, you know? We're just moving the way things are going. Like Curtis maybe buys into that a little bit, that this was a new age of powers beyond the state, you know?
Yeah, possibly so. I mean, I do think this is one of the tricks of Blair to make things which are clearly political decisions seem like they're out of, you know, we have no choice in the matter. Basically, it's already a done deal. And he talks in this way about technology, about climate change, about markets, about all sorts of things.
Infamously, last year, William Hague put out an article in the Times, right, just saying that we're in the age of migration. It's not that I want immigration. It's that you've just got to accept it. That's just what's happening.
But this is part of what Curtis is charting with these several documentaries, that it's about this political class making the locus of power diffuse.
I think you have tried to make this point. I'm beginning to understand it now. Yeah. You did say something similar in a previous episode, didn't you? Mm. Yeah.
And the markets rewarded them. Money did not flee from London as it had when previous Labour governments had been elected, and the boom continued. It has been the longest stock market boom this century. Many believe that because of deregulation, there is nothing to stop it continuing indefinitely. But there are others who are beginning to warn that all market booms come to an end and that the global markets are becoming increasingly unstable.
What do you mean Blair and Brown brought an end to boom and bust?
The question for politicians is, having given away so much power to control the markets, what happens when the bubble bursts?
I think the politicians have been put to sleep by the markets. I think they're... If the politicians, particularly Labour politicians, delved deep enough into their psyches, they would admit that they are quite terrified by the power of the markets, by the extent to which these people are sitting on the top of a house of cards. Labour politicians know there is something a bit dodgy about this system, but the boom, the extent of the boom, the wealth it's created for parts of Britain, for the southeast of England, for London, and for a group of very vociferous, very powerful people, has actually lulled politicians into a false sense of security. What happens when the boom ends?
In 1997, James Goldsmith died. He had tried to stop the onrush of the markets and failed. And at his death, the business class who now dominate politics took him back as one of their own. And with them came the politicians who, in their different ways, had helped the market to take power.
It's like vultures turning up to feast in the carcass.
Does anybody wonder why is Thatcher at James Goldsmith's funeral? What's the connection?
Weird, isn't it?
I do know of a connection between them, though. The 1975 referendum on the common market. Mm-hmm. They were both on the inside on that. They were both leading campaigners for the join, you know, stay in the common market. So they were acquainted from back then, at least. I'm guessing Goldsmith was probably a donor to the Tory party as well.
very interesting that they're actually turning up after, you know, calling him the unacceptable face of capitalism and all of that. So.
A year later, Tiny Roland died. His funeral was secret, and no one knows where he is buried. The only remaining member of the tycoons from the Claremont set is Jim Slater. He still runs a business analysing the markets, and is fascinated, as he always was, by games of chance, even Monopoly.
It works out that Pentonville Road, Angel of Islington and Euston, they're the light blue sites on the left, give you 159% return and are the best in terms of arithmetical return. But the dark green sites, which are, people would think were better, Oxford Street, Bond Street and Regent Street, only give 101% return, so they're very bad.
Wow, didn't know that.
The next best site are the orange ones, which is Bow Street, Vine Street and Marlborough Street, and they give 141% return. But they are better than Pentonville Road, Euston Road and Angel of Islington because there's an increased incidence of landing on them. You land on them more often. And the reason for that is there's a card in chance, go to jail, and you anyway, there's a thing on the board, go to jail. And if you go to jail, you're past the blue sites and about to land on the orange ones. In addition to that, there's another card in chance, advance to Pall Mall, which does the same thing, it takes you past the blue sites. Another one, advance to Marylebone Station. There's another one, go back three spaces, which from one position lands you on Vine Street. So it's an overwhelming case for having the orange sites. Now, most people don't know that.
Spreadsheet autist confirmed.
Masterstroke by Curtis to get the credits to go up over this dude autistically breaking down the game on Monopoly, you know.
I just want to say one thing about James Goldsmith. Was it before he died that obviously he became the father-in-law of Imran Khan, didn't he? His daughter Jemima Goldsmith married Imran Khan, became Jemima Khan, and then later separated, I think. Excuse me, just clearing my throat. Yeah, he became, and obviously she then later got with Russell Brand. That's another story. But yeah, Imran Khan, who then became, you know, he was the major cricketer, and then he became president or prime minister of Pakistan, and then was forced out of power last year, I think.
Yeah, I remember. Sort of on the run. Same guy.
Yes, Imran Khan, yeah. Quite popular in Pakistan, I think.
He was basically cooed last year.
Yeah, it seems like sort of constitutional, but not right. Or something, you know, yeah, like forced out by some ridiculous court decision or something like that. But obviously, Imran Khan is kind of like a, you know, one pawn, you could say, or one player in the current sort of shift in geopolitics where Pakistan, I think, was loyally allied to the US and Britain for a long time through the Cold War, I think. And just in recent times, now they're hedging their bets. They're trying to play all sides, China, Russia, Iran. Not India, they hate India, but, you know, like being friends with America. And so James Goldsmith obviously becoming a skeptic of globalism, of globalization as well. I wonder what he would have made of that, you know, if he was still alive now. I've no idea, but just interesting.
A couple of super chats before we get out of here. Retina says, hey, AA, I would like to say I'm sorry about super chatting. Tony Blair is real damn sexy on UO yesterday. Can you please forgive me, pretty please? Undefined. Bruderham says, in 2024, it's the wet Pajit man. The cake is getting bigger. Jobs are moving overseas. And a certain group in New York are selling more percentage of said cake. He also says, Gold Hat is pretty based on AIDS. It's literally a consequence of the polio vaccination campaign in the Democratic Republic of Congo in the 1950s. By Sabin and Koporowski, Wiki ELC. The refutation of it in the early 2000s is laughable. So that is a bit of history on AIDS. And he also says, imagine if Goldsmith was still alive, bankrolling Bowden in 2024.
Mm. It's interesting that convergence with a nationalist kind of theme, isn't it? That, you know, Goldsmith sees the way to counter the markets and their sort of, you know, vision of fungible people and profits and lost fungible desires is to sort of recrudesce a sense of the place, the attachment to place. And it sort of prefigures the sort of concept of the human that Curtis goes on to look at in The Century of the Self, the kind of isolated, atomized person. And Goldsmith has this instinct to try and recreate it through the nation state and sort of, you know, as it were, come back home.
You could say that he was a rooted cosmopolitan as opposed to George Soros.
Yeah, but it is interesting. It is also interesting how he got there through being burnt, through seeing how the system worked, then getting burnt by the system by forces bigger than himself. So he turns back to back force against the money power, to put it in Spengarian terms. So
that's it even seems like that was all that mattered, really. He was just pissed off. He just changed his views because he was annoyed at how he'd been treated or whatever. I just want to make one quick recommendation. There's a fascinating book called The Triumph of Conservatism, written in the 60s. It's about, I think, what Curtis is perhaps semi-consciously getting at here, which is that the old establishment was threatened, was challenged, and then reasserted itself. I think that is a summary of this series. And that arguably has been prefigured in other times.
And, just some final thoughts on the Mayfest set. Pretty good. Would you guys agree?
Absolutely, it's not necessarily the one of the more kinetic documentaries that comes later, but this was a real sea change at the time, and it was very exciting. And, you know, it started Curtis on this journey of looking into these things where, you know, you might feel he's a little bit unsure, and pulling all together, as I say, over the next sequence of documentaries, these influences of psychology, game theory, and, you know, foreign policy manipulation.
Yeah, I think it's terrific. It's some of the best Curtis. And if there was documentaries on that are as good as this and as interesting as this all the time, I'd be happy.
Yeah, I mean, I do wonder if he can make, you know, notably he's been quite quiet recently. So just wondering if the public would even be able to take stuff like this anymore.
Would that be because his last one really missed the public mood? It was like a year, around the same time as BLM, and he was just talking about white racism. And you know, BLM was not actually very popular. I just wonder if he just plopped that down at completely the wrong moment. You know, a lot of his latest series is about racism. And it's like, nah, you've completely misjudged the mood at this point. I wonder if it's that.
Was that Can't You Get You Out of My Head? I haven't seen that one yet.
Yeah, I haven't watched all of it, but like certainly some of it was really quite anti-white, and that's not normally his way. And it was like, have you gone off the rails here?
Yeah, it starts on the premise of Britain as an inherently racist nation. So I found it very difficult to swallow some of it, but it's, you know, it's expansive. It needs another look.
All right. Well, thank you very much. RCW with the last minute super chat, so saying cheers. Horace, where can people find you?
On Twitter at Infinite Horace or at eternalhorace.substack.com. Cheers, everyone.
And Simon?
And at Simon_Roberts on Twitter. Thanks, everybody, for watching.
And I will just remind everyone, do buy courses at the Academic Agency, Trivium and all the rest of them. I've got a Substack too. Like and subscribe, join the channel. Most importantly of all, ladies and gentlemen, get out.
What goes on in this town is none of your business.
As long as I'm living here, it is.
Then maybe you shouldn't be living here!
Well, that's easily fixed.